I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Renee Saragini Saklekar joins me again, the poet laureate for the city of Surrey and award-winning author, has a new book out, co-written with Mark Winston. Listening to the Bees is a collaborative book about bees and how they illuminate so much of ourselves and the world around us. Dr. Winston is one of the world's leading experts on bees and pollination. He gave Renee access to his many years of research, and alternating between his reflections, she provides poetry as to bees and the challenges they face today. They're her responses to his scientific archive, and often her work is thoughtful, amusing, and serious. One enjoys the book for the words that both Dr. Winston and Ms. Saklekar deploy. Renee Saragini Saklekar won the 2014 Canadian Authors Association Award for Poetry for her first collection, Children of Air India, which she was on with the first time she did the program. She returned a couple of years ago when the collection she edited with Wade Compton was released, The Revolving City, 51 poems, and the stories behind them was a 2016 City of Vancouver Book Award finalist. Visit thecanadaproject.wordpress.com. Mark Winston is scheduled to be on the program in the coming weeks. This new book is published by Knightwood Editions. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Renee Saklekar. Ms. Saklekar, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
I am honored to.
It's always fun to talk. I've had very happy memories of our chat, the first book, obviously, and then when you and Wade came by
a couple of years ago. You've been a fan, and you do a lot for writers really across the world, it would seem. So thank you. Thank you for your interest.
When did you and Dr. Mark Winston, when did you first meet?
You know, this is a good question. I don't know that I can pinpoint an exact time. It would certainly be in the last 5 to 6 years. He was very kind and compassionate when I was in the midst of writing my first book. I know he came to my launch. He's always taken an interest in supporting students at SFU and writers and artists. And where I really remember the connection is I have the great fortune to curate, along with people like Wade Compton, the poetry reading series downtown at SFU Vancouver called Lunch Poems at SFU that
right.
was co-founded by myself and a woman named Shauna Sylvester, who you may know, and really amazing people and a great team of volunteers. And Mark, again, very supportive as someone, you know, really involved with SFU Vancouver in the Center of Dialogue and so on. He would come down to lunch poem readings that are 12 to 1 the third Wednesday of the month. And it's a great way to connect with the SFU and downtown and Vancouver community. And it brings a slightly different audience, Joe, than the evening readings across town.
Right.
It's in the middle of smack in the middle of the day, deliberately, like lunch poems, right?
Yeah.
So my memory is connection around that, and through that, I don't remember the precise moment, but we began a series of conversations, and he was at that time writing a book that he was just embarking on. So, you know, I think of writing as a journey, and that book went on to win the Governor General's Award a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And we had no idea of any of this, and of course my book would go on to win awards and so on, but we were just, you know, people interested in language and bees. And so he told me about this book he was writing. It's called Bee Time. And I said, well, oh, I'm so interested because as a poet, like many poets, I'm kind of obsessed with bees.
Mm.
And I think he was kind of surprised by that and was like, really? Tell me more. And so we just got to talking, and eventually he interviewed me for his award-winning book, Bee Time, and I'm on page 168 of that book, and it's a really beautiful interview, and we just kind of connected. He has this very peaceful, lovely office at SFU Vancouver with lots of bee science, bee
uh-huh.
memorabilia. You know, he is kind of a leading honeybee guy in Canada, and I was very touched by his interest in my interest in bees and language. I'm not alone in this, and, you know, many, many poets, much more famous than I, have written and experienced bees in whatever way our art takes us. So
yeah.
that was the beginning, anyway.
Yeah, so I'll ask you about bees and their place in our culture, not only in our day-to-day life, but I'm interested in Mark. I'm talking to him in a few days.
Yeah.
What struck me as I'm reading his part of the book, his essays, is if, for a scientist, for an academic, and you mentioned, you know, one of the leading academics in his field, how well-rounded he is. I mean, he has an appreciation for words, for writing, for poetry.
Yeah.
And so when you guys, I can understand when you guys meet like that and get to talk about this common interest. I mean, it's his vocation, you know, it's his work over the years. I can understand how you could get along and how a book like this comes together.
Oh, well, I'm so glad. But, you know, it wasn't something we originally thought about doing a book. It was more this sort of series of conversations. And from that, he did something very generous and very beautiful. He invited me because I was kind of interested. You know, I was in his office looking around at his science articles. And I'm on the experimental side of poetry, and I'm really interested in language as material. So when he started talking to me and showing me his science archive, you know, over 40 years, mm-hmm. I got kind of excited, and he said, well, you're welcome to do whatever you want. Like, he was just very open and easy. It was a very kind of casual sort of, you know, you want to take some of these away, return them, but, you know, and I was just thrilled. And I'm not a scientist. I've been spending the last 2 years reading a lot of science, but for me, it's this completely foreign language that I'm enthralled with for many reasons other than the meaning, you know, because I'm kind of interested in bees. Well, a lot interested in bees.
Yeah, yeah.
Anything about bees grabs me, you know, if it's whatever it is. And so it just began as a series of conversations, but it then grew into an active collaboration. And what we found is we started to do these little readings, you know, around town, whether through poetry or through his different gigs. And audiences really seem to pick up on something between the two of us. You know, you can philosophize. I'll leave it to you to think of all those sort of duality, you know, man, woman, science, poetry, white, brown, language, different languages. There's this real duality and connection, and it seems to really speak to people. And so then we started getting gigs like at beekeepers associations and at poetry gigs, and we'd do these little kind of set pieces, you know, where he'd read a little bit from his first book and some burgeoning essays that were coming out of our collaboration, and I was like writing poems like crazy based on his science. And then we'd polish up a little kind of presentation, and we'd take it on the road, if you will. Mm. And audiences really seemed to respond, and we responded. You know, I don't want to speak for Mark. He'll have lots of thoughtful, lovely things to say. But for me, it just drove me deeper and deeper into, I guess, my lifelong quest, which is examining and playing with language as material.
Now, just the language that you would read in his work, because, I mean, he is a scientist, he's an academic. I mean, one would think that that's, well, it's scientific jargon, and it's, you know, a lot of Latin and things like that.
And I love it, and
you,
I love
you
it.
Do? Yeah. So
that's what's of most interest to me, as you can see in not all, but a good number of the poems, is me as a language artist playing with sound and the construction of science as sound, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm fascinated about as I'm reading your poetry is that you find, say, the beauty in that. Because a lot of people, you know, may pick up Mark's work and it may be very interesting and important. But, I mean, for a lot of people it might be boring. But for you, I guess it wasn't boring, was it, going through all
that
stuff?
The opposite. Yeah. It was the opposite. And, you know, if you see, this is my practice as a poet, and it's such an honor to speak with someone as widely read, like truly widely read as you, that, I mean, we have these discussions about Children of Our India. If we go back to Children of Our India, which was so much about loss and trauma, and my great joy is that this third book is so much about, yes, the ecological disaster facing the planet and the peril of the bees, but also the joy and abundance of being in nature with bees and honey and everything about them. But if you look at my first book, which you've done so thoroughly and so sensitively, you'll see that there as well, I was always searching for a language in which to tell the story. And the language I found was, of course, sadly, the language of loss through legal proceedings to do with the bombing of Air India Flight 182 and to do with the language of inquiry, the language of media. And then I brought my poet's self to all of that. But the work chose me. And I was reflecting as I was thinking about talking to you, you know, about this book, that once again, his work chose me. That's how I feel. That once I got a little glimpse in that lovely office of his of some of these science articles, and my psyche just went, bing, you know, I'm predisposed to bees, but then to see this very, dry, academic, Latin, formalist, rhetoric, procedure, methodology, I find it extremely beautiful, and it just speaks to me as a poet. And so that's what I was drawn to.
Well, what's the, I mentioned this just before we started, Renee, because he obviously has a relationship with bees that goes back a long time, but he seriously thought about this because that's his work. You have what you described a moment ago was an obsession with them. When we have stuff flying at us, say we're walking down the street or we're even in our house sometimes and you know, something flies at us, whether it's a bee, a moth, a wasp, a fly, a mosquito, the tendency for a lot of us is to swat it away. What's your reaction, say, when a bee comes up to you?
Well, that is such a fabulous question, and I think we have a bit of time, which is the great beauty of this process you created. So my initial reaction is probably, you know, I'm not a beekeeper, although they absolutely fascinate me, and I have learned so much in the last 2.5-3 years. So prior to my collaboration with Mark, I probably would have swatted as well or jumped away. And now, of course, if I can share anything with your wide band of listeners, never, ever swat anything that flies at you. Do not swat is pretty fundamental. You know, become still and gentle. I'm not into wasps, I can tell you that right now, although they also are very interesting. So I've been stung by a wasp, and it ain't fun. And, you know, not a life-threatening, but a pretty bad reaction.
Last summer,
I was getting some author photos done in preparation for this glorious book, and I was in Central Park in a bee garden, and there's a picture of me in the bee garden taken by my beloved husband in the book. But I was with my photographer. She's fabulous. And we were in Central Park in Burnaby in the bee garden, and she said, oh, put your hand to, you know, they have these bee sculptures made all out of flowers and plants. She said, oh, just put your hand up here. And I was immediately stung by a bee that was going about his business collecting nectar from the flowers. I forget what flowers they were. And it was a bumblebee, you know, a very friendly, lovely bumblebee, but I messed with its business, so it stung me. And then we went ahead with all the photographs, but my hands swole up, just something terrible, and I had to go to the doctor. So I really want to one day get into beekeeping, but I will have to really seriously think about, you know, having an EpiPen and having proper suiting. And, you know, what's been so interesting about being an urban dweller, you know, I live in a lovely apartment. We don't have a balcony. I'm looking out right now in my beautiful city parks. I feel such a gratitude to be in this city where shelter can be such a challenge, and I live in this lovely part of East Van, and I'm looking out at these dogwood flowers, and I now, of course, stop when I see a bee. I'm just, I usually take a picture. I try and figure out what kind of bee it is.
Yeah.
I've grown to really, you know, my sub-interest is in bumblebees and wild bees as opposed to honey-producing managed bees. But what this process uncovered was something much deeper, and it is my great privilege and delight to share a bit, if I may, with you about that comes up in the poetry in the book, and that I feel such a sense of joy because it's a kind of completion. As you will know, and as some of our listeners will know, I was born in India in the old British hill station Pune, now called Pune, about 500 miles northwest east of Bombay, Mumbai. You know, there's this family legend that I never really paid much attention to that my grandma had told me many years later, because I was so young, I didn't remember any of it. And like many immigrants, you know, my parents, when they came to Canada, they became very Canadian, hyper-Canadian, in fact. And my sister and I were brought up in English, and my dad eventually, coming from a Hindu background, you know, converted to Christianity, and my dad was a United Church minister, and so on. So this sort of the Hindu Maharashtrian Saklakar side of me, you know, it's there. I didn't deny it. I'm very proud to be an Indo-Canadian, all that. But I didn't really engage with it. I didn't connect with it. Now, you'll know that my given name is Sarojini, and it means in the lotus. And this connection to flowers and bees, there is this family legend that my grandma had shared with me that you know, after I was born and probably just before I was getting ready to leave for Canada at 6 months, I was sort of anointed with honey on my forehead, which is a common practice mm-hmm. in many cultures, just as a sign of good luck. And my grandma had this idea that, you know, there was a very special connection with our family to the Hindu goddess Lakshmi. And, of course, one of her symbols is the lotus. There's mm-hmm. another symbol with the bee. And my name, Sarojini, means in the lotus. So all of this was a kind of unearthing for me doing the bee science. So there's some very, very personal poems. You know, there's kind of three strands of poems in the book. There's the kind of intertextual, playing with Latin and science language and methodology, exploring Mark's journey as a scientist through his science work. There's that stream of poems. There's poems that very much were gifted to me by, I don't know, the muse, mm-hmm. the Holy Spirit, who knows, that really engage with the urgency of engaging with our environment and ecology and what's happening to the bees. And then there's these very, very personal poems that I had no idea were in me. I'd forgotten about them. I don't know where these came from, but something very deep in me felt a connection to that part of my family. My mom was brought up as Sunni Muslim mm-hmm. and married my father, and they were, you know, they basically had to run away to Canada. Ultimately, through the terrible tragedy that happened in my family, through the bombing and the murder of my aunt and uncle, my mother's youngest sister, so that's the Muslim side of the family, that was very much Children of Air India. And isn't it interesting that this book, in part, in addition to all these other things I'm doing, is a kind of pay-in, a kind of praise song to my father's family, the Saklikar family in Mumbai. The family home is really beautiful. You know, they're privileged and middle-class wealthy people, but it's called Shanti Dut, the House of Peace. And my grandma had this amazing garden, a rose garden, and she was a very devout Lakshmi Brahmin Hindu and was really into all this stuff with the bees and the Hindu legend and the Vedic legends. And so I just kind of wanted to honor that. And very tragically this spring, my auntie Padmaja, she passed away after a battle with cancer. And so, it's all very kind of swirling and in the moment, and I feel very blessed by it all.
You know, I'm thinking of the poetry in the book and hearing, you know, obviously your background just a moment ago. Your relationship with bees is almost faded, isn't it?
Yeah, I love that you say that. Like, I don't want to say it because I worry, you know, it sounds a little too maybe twee, but
yeah.
I do feel that. And as a poet, of course, unearthing these memories, and, you know, some of these are folk legends, like the idea, you know, Virgil, the very famous Latin poet, through his gorgeous poems, the Georgics, that are referenced by both Mark and I in the book, he talks about that legend of the anointment of honey and the bees visiting the baby and the forehead. And so in the very beginning of the book, I have that poem, The Legend of the Bees. So
yeah, and so you know, when you first talk to Mark and say you're obsessed with bees, I mean, you know, you're obsessed with bees as some people might be with dogs, say.
Yeah.
And then as you're writing the poetry, then you realize, well, hey, the bees have been such a part of my life. As you're writing about bees, I mean, they obviously teach us a lot about ourselves. I mean, after writing this, do you find that well, I guess you've tied all of these things together now, haven't you?
Yeah, and again, that sense of completion, right? And that sense of honoring the connectivity to the world and to the great mystery and practical necessity of getting human beings, Homo sapiens, to smarten up and connect. I'm reading this gorgeous book that I bought at Hager Books because they did a little promo for my book, because this past Saturday the book came out,
right.
April 28, 2018. The book came out in bookstores everywhere, and it was April 28 was Canadian Independent Bookstore Day, and lovely Hager Books. I really want to give a shout-out to them in Carisdale. They had me as an author there, and, yeah, it was this sense of completion, you know. And there I found a book on forest bathing. And, you know, there's all this science now that the pheromones and oils released by trees scientifically really help us, human beings and other creatures, on so many levels, but just inhaling the scent of trees is really good for our immune system.
Yeah.
And again, learning so much from Mark, from beekeepers, from scientists, it's very humbling and just so slow down and be a bit more attentive. So now in my local neighborhood, I see my local East Van folks planting bee-friendly, wild and indigenous bee-friendly flowers, and immediately, you know, at certain times of the day, you will find, usually when the sun is round and fat, the bumblebees, and there are mason bees in our community garden. So, yeah, I'm always kind of looking for bees. And
So I want to get back to that that you mentioned a moment ago, the when you were taking photos in Central Park in Burnaby.
Yeah.
And you got stung.
Yeah.
The reaction from a lot of people would be to swat, to whack, try to kill the bee that stung you, certainly curse, get very angry.
Yeah, no, I wasn't angry.
Yeah.
I did smack that bee fast because I thought it was a wasp, and
right.
I had a terrible reaction to wasps.
Yeah, yeah. So that
bee didn't survive our encounter, but
yeah.
I was lazy or sharp, but I felt no anger. And the worst thing you can do around bees, what I've learned from Mark and beekeepers, is be soft, be still, let them go about their business.
Yeah.
They just want to do their teleological purpose, and you know they don't have a long lifespan to do it, and they're on a mission. Leave them alone, observe them, don't swat, go still. Now, for the photo shoot, I was wearing red. Not a great idea. What I've learned from beekeepers and from Mark and Science and watching them, like white and light colors, the colors they love, light purple, light blue. Today for our interview, I'm wearing yellow and blue. Don't wear black and don't wear red. You know, I had a red top on. I was less than smart. It was totally on me. And
yeah.
The other thing I did when I got home, you know, my arm swole up quite a bit. I don't want to be romanticizing about it. And it was hot, you know, our lovely hot summer. My arm really swole up, and I emailed Mark, and he was like, whoa, you know, you should maybe go see a doctor. And so I did eventually, but I was all fine. One of the things I did was I iced it, and I put honey on it.
Huh.
And the honey I put on was from glorious, fantastic Westham Island apiary. So it's unpasteurized, raw, BC honey, gift from a dear friend. That's the other great thing about being bee crazy. You know, you get wonderful little gifts.
Right, right.
But I put that honey right on my wound, and it really helped.
Huh. So you're obviously you're someone who one can turn to for advice when you know.
No, really, it's not me. Turn to people like Mark and to actual beekeepers. Don't come to me for God.
Yeah.
I can share my journey.
Yeah.
But it's
an interesting journey because, as I said, a lot of us would be angry and wouldn't know how to comport themselves if they were, you know, say, in the vicinity of a bee. That's the other thing about bees. They suffer from the bad PR of getting, confused with wasps.
Yeah, no.
And wasps are dangerous for a lot of people, right, who especially have allergies and the sort.
Yeah, and bees can be too.
Right.
But wasps are predators. They're a whole other... bees are so focused on doing what science, nature, evolution, God has put up them on the planet to do, and it's so beautiful, you know. And without them, of course, as Mark so eloquently says, as we know, we could not have food. We would not have. We would not have flowers.
So they do suffer this threat, and the threat is from us as people, because we've you know destroyed their habitat with pesticides and the sort. Yet they manage to survive. Are you hopeful that the way we grow food and the way we react to bees in our society today, in our culture, that might say help their survival a little bit more, since we've done so much to destroy a lot of them?
Wow, yeah, I love the word hope. People sometimes ask me a version of that question, well, are you optimistic? And,
uh-huh.
you know, the thing with optimism, which I'm not antithetical to, is optimism is sort of like a business case analysis where you've reviewed all the factors and indicators and you know your probability and chances. A former premier that I won't name, you know, to talk a lot about being optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really my thing. It's not my jam. hope, though, I love that you said, am I hopeful? Because hope, to me, is faith when there are not always anything to say that it's going to be okay. Hope is this great mystery, right? A bird with feathers, as Emily Dickinson said, you know, that, yeah, I am hopeful because I refuse to give up, that we are going to get it, I hope, and maybe the world will teach us that if we're not hopeful, therefore unable to change, we will die. We will die as a species, we will die as a planet. And so we need to cultivate hope. And if you're hopeful, then maybe you're going to get educated. Maybe you'll stop, look up from your phone. And I say this without any judgment. I'm addicted to my beautiful rose gold pink iPhone. but look up from your phone, be still, don't swat, plant with as little pesticides as you can.
Yeah.
I have these old-time East Vancouver Portuguese folks and neighbors up the street from me, and one of my favorites is this Mrs. Maria. She can't do it anymore. She's an amazingly spry 89, but for years in our neighborhood, her front lawn was a crop-growing garden, and she tried to use as little pesticides as possible. She would search out native indigenous plants, friendly to wild bees. There's some glorious information in Mark's book, too, and he'll talk about it, you know. What can we do as humans to just be a bit more sensitive? And, oh, another thing I wanted to add, you have an encounter with a bee at a picnic or on a park bench or whatever because you're eating food that attracts them and then the wasps, don't swat and no sudden gestures. This is what I've learned from beekeepers especially. Yeah. Just slow, steady, gentle gestures. Don't engage in like really abrupt, angular gestures.
Yeah. They teach us calmness, don't they?
Yeah.
I want to ask you about your practice of poetics, because this fascinates me as I'm reading your book. You were trained as a lawyer, is that right?
Yeah.
And you mentioned a moment ago reading all of the research that Mark's career has yielded, this 40 years of stuff.
I haven't read all of it, but I've dipped into it.
Yeah, you read a lot of it. Yeah, it satisfied your obvious interest for bees. Are you a fast reader?
No. Oh, what a great question. I am, I think, one of the world's slowest writers and readers. It took me 5 years, many ups and downs, to write my first book, which, you know, went on to do quite well. I'm slow. And I think, we have to ask Mark about it. I think maybe he felt a little, you know, like, wow, it should have taken a long time. And I could have gone on. I'm still writing bee poems based on his science. I haven't stopped.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm slow reader. Real slow reader, real slow writer.
See, I assumed because you studied law that you would be a fast reader because you'd have to read all these briefs and the sort and, you know, these academic books. But that's fascinating that you mentioned you're a slow reader. As a writer, then, when you have all these thoughts, all these words, all these feelings that you want to pour out of yourself, does your mind say, does it work faster in that regard, or is it equally as slow, say?
What a great question. I think my mind can race ahead. It's just a big jumble. It's through the act of writing. Certainly for me, documents and the archive are my muse. I've just accepted that now. When I'm in Mark's science archive, if you will, that's where I'm percolating best. So a practical example would be this summer, we had the great privilege of signing a book contract, and we needed to get this book out, and I had lots of poems still to write. I knew they were in me, and Mark's been glorious. Like, he's kind of gently prodding and sort of saying, well, what about this? What about this? And so I took myself off to a secret library, and a very quiet library, open to the public, but not a lot of people know about it in Victoria, the Legislature Library, and where you can spread out all your work and, you know, I have all these documents, and they are my muse. The science is my muse. So I just gave myself, you know, turned off the phone, turned off the computer, away from home, in a library, beautiful, long desk, spread everything out, and just sat with the bee science and just listened to it and explored and played with different patterns and combinations. You'll see in the introduction to the book and throughout the poetry that you know, I've tried in these poems. I think they're some of the best I've ever written for me as a poet. You know, I'm always learning, growing as a poet, that I really wanted to explore the range of what poetry and language and science can do, and I felt the bees were giving me little signals on how to do that.
Yeah. And so as you're writing, and you're struck, say, by inspiration or in some cases a deadline, you know, the urgency of a deadline, how then do you react as the writer? Because if you read at a certain pace and you write at a certain pace, does that say, I mean, these outside factors that you can't control, mm-hmm. I mean, what does that do to your creativity, say?
Well, it's so interesting. I think you've kind of, in your very thoughtful way, kind of nailed it. I think it's a chaotic, almost contradictory impulse. On the one hand, I respond to deadlines very well. Uh-huh. That's the lawyer in me. That's the training, right? You know, being in the practical world. And I'm such a dreamy poet self, my real self, my true Sarah Jeannie self is so not of this world that I'm, as my husband will attest, kind of a slow dawdler. So I think the two things happen at once in a very interesting way. It acts as a disciplinary measure. So I got myself to the library, brought all my stuff, put it all out there. And then I put all of that out of my mind. I actively tell myself, I have all the time in the world. I have nothing but time. Mm. And I think turning off electronic distractions, no internet, no phone, nothing, just with the science. You know, some of it fairly old, like it's a 40-year-old archive that Mark so generously just, a lot of it's open access. And by the way, it led me to other open access papers. And I just admire these bee scientists so much. I've referenced them all in the book, in the back. I think our appendix really rocks because for those really interested in the hard science and in our sources and everything, it's all there.
You can find places to go to later on, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And you can go deeper with us, right? Yeah. So it's an invitation. It's a journey. And so, yeah, I just, it's as long as it takes, as long as it takes. And when I let myself do that, then the bees and the bee science starts. You know, you have to create space to let that rise up and speak to you, you know, and not have too much of an agenda. Just play. And so you asked the second part of your question is so good. Like, then what happens? Like, what captures me? And it's almost always a pattern, sound patterns, language patterns. And I write and talk about that in the introduction, and then you see the poems enacting that.
Yeah. So what? I read an interview you gave someone else in terms of when the poem is done.
Yeah.
And so when I mean, you mentioned, you know, that this is a journey. Obviously the journey doesn't stop, because you mentioned a sec ago that you're still writing bee poems.
Oh, yeah, I'll never stop, yeah. I hope, I pray. Yeah, let the poem never end, Joe. Let it never be ending.
Yeah, it's a marvelous way to look at life, but at the same time, when you see poems in this book,
yeah,
I mean, you know, one would think they're done. I mean, do you have to stifle yourself to not want to, say, fix something or change something?
Oh, yes, it's painful. Now, I have the great privilege of having a fantastic press and a great editor, Silas White, mm-hmm. and the great team at Knightwood. I can't say enough about Knightwood and their distributor, Harbor Publishing. And so they help make it better. And, you know, Mark and Silas and I going through the poems, you know, how to make it better. I think about the reader. Left to my own wayward, experimental, avant-garde, crazy devices, you know, I can create poems that I would love and that a small band of experimental poets might love, but, you know, might be just a little too inaccessible to folks. So I tried to give myself and the work what it needed to create the best poems I could. But, yeah, I don't know a writer worth their salt that looks at their work in a book and go, oh, yeah, I nailed that. I mean, to me, the muse would just cast me down immediately if I were to do that.
And so Mark does provide feedback in terms of something you've written, and that's something that I admire about Mark. As an academic, he has this eye for the beauty of language and poetry, and so his feedback has obviously, it's been invaluable. Have you changed anything because of something he said, say?
Yeah, and I have to say, it didn't feel like it was mean and valuable. I would get quite cross and cranky. He'll talk about that, I'm sure. He's very gentle and lovely. But we don't always see eye to eye, and I think that makes it, there's this lovely tension, right, that makes great art, I think. He would give feedback, and a lot of it I would swat away, and then I would go back and go, okay, maybe a point there, and same with Silas. And then there are other times that I have to stand up for what I hear, the music I hear, because I'm the poet, after all, and I'm hearing a vibrancy, a vibration, a tuning that sometimes other folks don't hear, and I have to stay true to that. So it's a balancing, it's a calibration, always seeking to allow the work to be what it needs to be.
The other thing that I found quite thoughtful in your writing in this book, listening to the bees, is you mention, I think more than once, but there's one instance that I remember. You mentioned a book that once belonged to your father-in-law.
Yeah.
And this is what interests me about you is this reverence you have, obviously, for words, but books themselves.
Yeah.
And that's something that's been very important in your life, throughout your life, right?
Yeah. What a glorious, perceptive thing. And thank you for mentioning one of my favorite parts of the book where I write about Keats. It's in response to Mark's beautiful essay on poetry, science of poetry, and then I respond in a little piece called Notes from the Margin, and in it I reflect on Keats's idea of negative capability, and what's at my side while I'm writing that little essay is the book, A Collected Works of Keats, that I got when my father-in-law sadly passed away, and he was such a lover of books and opera and art, and this beautiful Irishman, you know, and I'm so glad you brought that up, that the book as object, the document as object, objects themselves, the text themselves, this goes to this idea of language as material, in and of themselves they really interest me, and thank you for picking up on that. And I believe, I have the book here, but I don't have it open to that particular part, that you know, I look at the texture and feel of the pages and the smell of the pages and everything. So the senses are engaged, and bees teach us this all the time. Mm. You know, you can't be around bees and beekeepers and bee science and honey and the flowers and everything that without really engaging with the senses. So I have definitely, maybe this is tied to that family legend of the honey on the forehead and the goddess Lakshmi, but the object itself, language is an object and material, truly speaks to me.
And I mean, it is a beautiful book, listening to the bees, the colors of the cover, inside, obviously, the fly leaf. The book that I mentioned a moment ago, your father-in-law's book, is an older one.
Yeah.
Weather-beaten, probably.
Yep.
What'll it be like for you to have your copy of Listening to the Bees and see that age, say?
Oh, well, it would be amazing, amazing. You know, it's interesting, putting out poems in the world, essays, stories, published books. This is my first hardcover book, and thank you for honoring the design. I thought the publisher and the designer, full props. I had a very powerful idea, Mark and I did, but I particularly did, that I wanted a certain shade of color. I'm obsessed with this symbol, the hexagon, of course, which is so integral to bee structure and bee architecture for hives, and picked up everywhere in nature and chemistry, everywhere. And I really wanted gestures and symbols, and there they all are in the book. So if this were to be an object that someone after me were to love and hold the way I love and hold the Keats book, that would be pretty super awesome.
Yeah, I mentioned your father-in-law, and people know who your husband is, and both of you are great readers, and that's the thing that I've admired about both of you over the years. Widely read in various, you know, not only fiction, poetry, nonfiction. what's your collection like at home? You've seen mine. You've been where I live, and you've seen my book collection. I'm always curious to know what other people, what they have.
Oh, well, Joe, no one beats you on the book thing. You demand on the book thing. I have to say my husband truly impresses me. Folks will know he's Adrian Dix, our current BC Minister of Health. And given what he has to do, he's currently reading a book, among many policy books, that he asked me to get him for his birthday, and it's about the HBO TV series The Wire. Mm. He's also reading Blood, Sweat, and Fear by Eve Lazarus, whom I met at Hager Books, our local BC author.
Great historian.
And lovely person. Mm-hmm. And I am reading here, I'm just going to my stack of books by my, we have our respective stack of books, mm-hmm. By our couch in our little living room here. Okay, here's my list. I'll send you a picture of it later.
Yeah.
Number one, Michelle Obama, A Life, Peter Slevin, Vintage.
Uh-huh.
You Are a Badass by someone named Jen Sincero. Forest Bathing by Dr. Qing Li. A style book called Dress Like a Parisienne. And one of my all-time favorite paperbacks I carry around with me that my husband gifted me 2.5 years ago, Gretchen Reynolds, The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, and Live Longer.
Huh. See, it's a very eclectic list. But
thank you, my friend. Yeah, and I'm loving it. And the Michelle Obama biography, I am just in love with. I think there's so much on the Obamas, but Peter Slevin, serious journalist, props to him. I had low expectations. Basically, I bought it because she's wearing a fab pink dress on the cover, but it's so great. I actually bought it as a gift for Adrian, but now I have it on my file.
Yeah. So, we live in Vancouver, so we're all spaces at a premium. What do you guys do with your books? I mean, did you keep them all? Did you pass them on to other people?
All of the above. We have way too many in stacks, and we have these great bookshelves that my brother-in-law helped us source. So we got a lot of books. Nothing compared to you, though, my friend. You demand there with the books. But I'd also be remiss if I didn't give a shout-out to some poets. So one of the poetry things I have very close by is I have a great privilege of being on the board of the Capilano Review, and I collect their issues. So what a glorious journal. And right now beside me I've got Summer 2017 issue 3.32 and Winter 2016 3.28. I also have chapbooks. These are little books, less than 48 pages, that I'm obsessed with, from wonderful Ottawa publisher Rob McClellan from Above Ground Press. And he just mailed me a stash of chapbooks that include a woman who passed away very suddenly, tragically. She's an American poet, Martha Reed, and beautiful, beautiful person. And today's May Day, and I wanted to give a shout-out to her, her labor in producing. She handcrafted beautiful chapbooks, including one about a long poem I'm writing. And so that just completes what I was saying about what I'm reading right now.
Mm-hmm.
I just ordered some of her work from Ottawa's Above Ground Press, and I'm a huge collector, along with bees. My next obsession probably are chapbooks, these little poetry books, usually less than 48 pages. I think the United Nations defines a book as something that's more than 48 pages, and anything less than 48 pages, particularly in the poetry world, is called a chapbook, and I collect them, and I'm obsessed with them and create them myself. And I've had the great privilege of having fairly reputable literary chapbook presses, small micro presses, seek me out because of some of the work I'm doing. And she was one of those, thanks to Above Ground Press, that introduced us. And she passed away, I think, in her late 40s, just very suddenly in April. And many of us are just devastated by that. And so if anyone out there has my chapbook by her, it's called Thought J. Bapp.
Uh-huh.
It's a true collector's item because there will never, it's handcrafted with black silk thread sewn together. It's got a laser die cut front.
it's amber brown, and there'll never, ever be another one like it.
Now, the chapbooks are portable, so you can take them anywhere if you're on the SkyTrain or the bus or something like that.
Yeah, so much.
What, I mean, as you know, I have a number of books myself, and I've avoided reading off of a tablet or an e-device.
Yeah.
Have you done that?
Well, you know, since we last chatted in some depth, I have kind of crossed over.
Yeah.
I have to confess, my preference always is for, because we've talked about it, the object,
right,
whether it's a book or a chapbook. But because I do a lot of this intertext work with languages material, I'm often reading a whole bunch of things all at once.
Yeah.
And it's just easier to have them uploaded on my phone, and I've taken to the occasional book on the phone. And I'll just let folks know, Listening to the Bees is available as an e-book.
Yeah, and I've done the same too as of late. I mean,
yeah,
I had to read a book for the show, and that's the only way they could have gotten it to me was a thing. So I had to read it off a tablet, and you know, I didn't mind it as much as I thought I would. You know,
yeah.
I resisted it for years.
Yeah.
But I found that I don't remember stuff as much. Not in terms of the content, but I mentioned that the passage in Listening to the Bees where you talk about the Keats book from your father-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
You said you didn't have your copy of the book open.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered sort of what side of the page it was on,
mm-hmm,
because I read it off of, say, a hardcover book.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have remembered that, say, if I'd read your book on a device.
It's such a beautiful thing you shared, and so thoughtful. Of course, that is the thing about the object, the book itself, and
where it is roughly in the book, and
yeah,
and
your whole experience is completely different, and I think
yeah,
it's very wise of you to relate to memory. You know that I think our memory of I've just been looking at for that section. Yes, you're quite right. It's page 148 in the book, Notes from the Margin. And our memory and the object are so interlinked. And so there is this transitory kind of ephemeral nature when you're on your Kindle and phone. And it can be very useful, like reading on transit, because I take transit everywhere at night in the winter when it's dark and your phone lights up and you can increase the font. That helps.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing, I think, for me, there's nothing that can replace you know, turning over the pages. And like in our book, you'll notice that it's this glorious butter, very light butter yellow, and
mm-hmm,
it's on recycled paper that's kind of slightly rough to the touch, and all the design elements on the color and the photographs. I don't know. To me, it's one of the great joys of this book that we've created a really solid literary work of poetry and personal reflective essays, and then also, it's such a beautiful object.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing, notes from the margin. I guess that's mm-hmm, what you call them. When you'd have Mark's work in front of you,
mm-hmm,
did you really write in the margins?
I absolutely did.
Huh.
Yeah, I should have maybe thought of. And I have pictures, I think. But oh yeah, if I were to show you my rough drafts, often the poems they're almost always created first in pencil, and I would scribble poems. I would carry individual printed copies from his over 40 years of research. So some of them quite old. He would put them in these lovely plastic folders, and I would take them little by little from this immense archive, and I would carry them around. He can attest to this, and
yeah,
I would sit in coffee shops or libraries or at home or whatever, because it's overwhelming, you know, otherwise, and just work on an essay or two, reading it, because I couldn't understand it. You know, I'm reading it for things that interest me.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, scribble little thought patterns, little patterns of words, little intertexts, weave them into some other idea that was coming to me from being attentive to that process, in pencil, in the margin, for sure, and on the backs of things, and, yeah, scraps of paper. That's the way I roll.
Yeah. So when do you take your writing, and then, I mean, it obviously has to get to a computer, right?
Yeah, eventually, sadly, yeah.
Yeah, and so what's, you keep the paper that you've written on?
Oh, of course. And,
yeah,
you know, we've donated the actual master bedroom in our little rental to my office, and Yeah, my office is really, really crazy. And so there's lots of boxes and stacks of scraps and little bits, and it's very, very hard for me to let go of that. And eventually, when it just feels like a certain bolus or a certain collection is kind of saying, let me out of here, let me out of here, because I know that in order to get it into book form, it has to go on the computer, and that's the only reason I do that, that eventually I will transcribe them into a Word document. And Mark and I have to pay quite a bit of attention. I mean, he can talk about this, to what our process was, because he's writing the essays and I'm writing poems.
Yeah.
He's very, you know, he's a scientist. He's very careful. He's very methodical. I'm very careful, too, but I'm not on the scale that he is. And so we each had our processes of how we kept track of our drafts. And, you know, we'd have to spend some time thinking about that.
There's a poem in the book that's, I don't know how to describe it. It's written in a round.
Oh, which is that the one that's, well, tell me what page it's on, because there's several kind of like that.
Yeah, it's let me just flip through here. I know where it is in the book, but
is it the one in the center of the book?
Yeah, it's let's see here. I see now. 110 to 111.
Oh, well, thank you for asking me about it. It's probably one of my all-time favorites. Yes, this was something truly that I felt given, you know, by being attentive to the science, to the bees, to my own past. You know, if you're a person of faith, then you would say it was gifted by the Holy Spirit. If you're materialist, it's being close to the documents, listening to the documents. Very much, you know, in a meditative state, in a kind of otherworldly state. And so the title of the poem is Bee Raga, and a raga is a type of Sanskrit, Hindi dance, song.
Mm-hmm.
And often, typically, a raga is in the morning or the evening. It's often praise-related, like a praise song.
Mm-hmm.
And Brahmani Devi is the Hindu Vedic goddess of bees. She's the goddess of bees. And on some level, this poem, which is 1, 2, 3, 4 stanzas with a little envoy or finishing triplet, and each of the stanzas is, I believe, it should be 6 lines, right? So that whole pattern of the hexagon. It's not literally, but it's sort of evocatively of the bees. It's in the voice of the bees. These are the bees singing their praise for this goddess.
And so I can see how you would write that, say, on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
You can't get it that way in a Word document. So when you have to give it to your publisher, I mean, there's a certain amount of instruction that you have to give them so that it looks the way it does in the book, right?
You're so fantastic. Thank you. Thank you for asking me that. So here's what we did. Now, I must say, when I was writing it, you know, it's what I tell my students, because now I get the great privilege of teaching creative writing at SFU and SFU Surrey, SFU Vancouver, and BCC downtown. And I'm just mainly, everyone has their own jam. Everyone has their own thing about what they're doing, whether it's visual or story, narrative. I tend not to be so much narrative, but for me it's sound and pattern. So I was in this kind of hypnotized, meditative, quiet, otherworldly state, and these words just started coming to me. And I just started jotting words down. I did not, they were just scattered all over the page. They were not in this form. The form came much later as I spent more and more time with the words and the rhythm of the words. So first, the content just came out of me. It was like I was taking dictation.
Yeah.
And then I left it for a long time, maybe a couple of years. And then I would come back to it, and I would play with the arrangement of the content and honing the content for rhythm and pattern and sound and image. Much later, like this poem probably took me 5 years to write.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe more. And finally it dawned on me as I'm in, you know, the bee archive, and I said, oh, this is the voice of the bees. So I had to go back and revise and revisit many times over once I got that image, oh, this is the voice of the bees. And then this whole idea of God given and the goddess, you know, really communing with this goddess, and I truly felt that. And at the very end, I realized I really need, like I physically need to have this poem in the center of this book.
Mm.
And the beauty of my publisher and Mark and everything, like again, this feeling of joy and gratitude and abundance was they were they're into it. You know, this fantastic book designer, like, how lucky, how amazing is that? And so I scratched out lines in this formation on a piece of paper, took a picture, and texted it to one of my editors, this lovely woman working with Silas, Amber McMillan, and I texted her a picture of how I wanted it, and they created it.
Hmm.
Like, how awesome is that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's marvelous to talk to you because it's a book that I've enjoyed reading the last few days, and so to get insight into what you're thinking, and not only that, but the process of putting a book like this together was just fascinating for me. This time that we've spent together today has just whizzed by, and I find that I can talk forever with you. And over the years, having talked to a number of authors and writers and various other artists over the years, I've always enjoyed our chats. And so I can't thank you enough for the time this morning.
Oh, the thanks is mine for your attentiveness and your thoughtfulness. It's a privilege and a pleasure, and I look forward to hearing more of what you'll do with Mark. Thank you.
Listening to the Bees is published by Knightwood Editions. Renee Sarah Jeannie Sacklicar joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.